I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, what's behind the ethnic violence in Kenya? But first, Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke called on Congress today to act fast to get more cash into the hands of American consumers. The Fed chief testified in Congress today and said, while the U.S. is not in a full-blown recession yet, the economy is slowing. Lawmakers are considering a $100 billion economic stimulus package. Unemployment is at a two-year high. America's largest banks have had multi-billion dollar losses. Gas prices are hovering around $3 a gallon. The housing market continues to soften. Lawmakers are finding rare bipartisan support for the stimulus package, and today President Bush threw his support behind the idea. Joining us now, Sarah Leek of the Wall Street Journal. And Sarah, lawmakers seem to be asking Bernanke today for his stamp of approval or suggestions. Did he give any specific suggestions?
Well, he was very careful not to take one side or the other, but he certainly did give greater momentum to certain proposals and certain ideas that have been floating around on the Hill. And I think he probably gave even more momentum to this stimulus legislative effort that had already been moving pretty quickly.
Well, he's expected to lower a key interest rate next week for the fourth time since September. And both parties agree a stimulus package is needed. But let's go to the parties then. Break down for us what Republicans want versus Democrats.
Sure. Well, they do seem to be starting out in fairly different places, but both sides really want to get something done. So it appears that there's really a serious effort going on to compromise. For Democrats, compromise is probably going to mean doing away with the pay-as-you-go budget rule that would normally be requiring them to offset, you know, tax increases or new spending programs. That would make it really hard to get a stimulus package through Congress. And in fact, Mr. Bernanke's comments today suggested it would be counterproductive to raise taxes in the context of a stimulus. Also, Democrats would have to probably eliminate or pare back the public works spending that some of them wanted to do as part of a stimulus package, because Republicans are signaling that too much spending is a bad idea. They want to keep the package relatively small. On the Republican side, they're probably going to have to accept some programs, additional expansions of things like food stamps or unemployment insurance that under normal circumstances they would really probably prefer not to expand.
But how exactly is cash expected to get into the hands of Americans soon? I mean, is there going to be one of those rebate checks sent out?
I think there does seem to be pretty good prospects for a rebate check. Mr. Bernanke's comments today about rebates were positive, and there's interest on both Democratic and Republican sides of the aisle. And, of course, that's been a linchpin of past stimulus packages. And so people have been talking about a $300 to $600 rebate check that will go out to people. And they're talking about trying to do it relatively soon, you know, by mid-year in order to be effective. It would be difficult to put in place, but it sounds like there's enough momentum behind it that it probably will be part of a legislative package.
Well, President Bush has said he would dedicate his last year in office to making his tax cuts permanent. They're set to expire at the end of 2010. Democrats have said these tax cuts only, you know, really benefit the wealthy. Lawmakers tried to get Ben Bernanke to wade into the whole thing, and here's how he, in part, responded.
Those who want to have low taxes, and low taxes have many benefits, also need to support a very disciplined spending side as well. Those who want to spend more need to find the revenues to support that. So as I've said a number of occasions, the law I'm most in favor of is the law of arithmetic. What comes in has to equal what goes out at some point.
Sarah, that's a little bit of what you said before, but did he, you know, he said a bit more about the tax cut and whether it should be made permanent. What did he say?
Right. Well, clearly the broader Republican agenda and the agenda of President Bush, as you said, is to do a permanent extension of some of these 2001 and 2003 tax cuts. But Mr. Bernanke's comments today were much more on the side of focusing the current legislative effort for economic stimulus on short-term measures, which means not likely to see a permanent tax cut extension as part of this package. And it sounds like Republicans are increasingly willing to go that route in the interest of getting something done quickly. But they've also made clear they plan to make that point about wanting to make those tax cuts permanent, you know, in their longer-term debate.
He also seemed to be saying, you know, the law of arithmetic, what goes out must come in at some point. Mm-hmm. If you're going to have your tax cuts, you've got to get the revenue somewhere else.
That's right. I mean, and that sort of bolsters Democrats' pay-as-you-go principle that they came into office touting, this idea that if you're going to do big tax cuts, you have to sort of replace the revenue. And that's been an argument they've been making all year. It's not an argument that washes very well with some of the Republican members of Congress who really think tax cuts in and of themselves will, you know, grow the economy and create long-term investment.
And Sarah Leek, just one last quick comment as an observer of all of this. His predecessor, Alan Greenspan, was notorious for his sort of speaking in haiku, you know, in ways that people really couldn't understand, or if they did, went hog wild off in a certain direction. How were people reacting to Bernanke's speech?
I think people are seeing him as much more blunt and straightforward, and I think that probably was what people were looking for from him at this time. There's so much uncertainty in the economy and all these different areas, and lawmakers are really struggling to try to come up with the right policy and try to deal with all their own differences, that I think they see it as really helpful that Mr. Bernanke was fairly straightforward in his comments and in sort of ranking some of the ideas that have been floated.
Sarah Leek of The Wall Street Journal talking to us about Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke's appearance in Congress today. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, now to Kenya, which we want to try to understand more. There was new violence this week, adding to the three-week-old crisis sparked by disputed elections, in which more than 600 people were killed, hundreds of thousands displaced, and the tourism-based economy was threatened in one of the few stable countries in East Africa. The political stalemate is between the opposition leader, Raila Odinga, of the Luo tribe, and the sitting president, Muawi Kibaki, of the Kikuyus. In a moment, we want to speak with Pulitzer Prize winner Caroline Elkins, who is an expert on the ethnic tensions in Kenya. But first, Scott Baldoff, Christian Science Monitor correspondent in Nairobi. Scott, the opposition won a big victory in Parliament this week. They won the speaker position, but the opposition leader, Raila Odinga, called for 3 days of protest of what he sees as that rigged presidential election that he narrowly lost. Yesterday, there was a lot of violence on the first day of those protests. What's happening today?
There's a pattern to this. The mornings start out fine. People go to work. But then by noon, the first scuffles start to happen. Protesters generally out in the slum areas start to agitate and the police respond. And then by the late afternoon, we're already starting to count the dead. Today appears to be quite deadly. The opposition claims that about 7 people were killed. Some reporters actually saw some of the shootings in a township called Kibera. There has also been similar reports of shooting in other parts of the country, but it does appear to be isolated groups who are doing the agitating, but the problem is the police are responding with live bullets. That is where we're starting to see the death toll.
Well, now we're hearing other reports out of Nairobi, and granted they were earlier today, that protests from the opposition appeared to have lost steam. Are you seeing that the political protests may have lost steam, but something else is replacing it? I mean, what are you seeing there?
I think both things are happening at the same time. You are certainly seeing fewer numbers of protesters showing up. At the beginning, there was a great deal of energy. You had people of all walks of life showing up to protest against these elections, which many Kenyans, even if they are not supporters of Mr. Odinga, saw as stolen. These demonstrations became more violent. Then you started to see people peel away, and as it appeared that there was going to be an impasse, neither leader seems ready to even sit down and chat, to even work out how to start working towards a settlement of this dispute. Now you have a very hardcore group of some activists, but increasingly a reliance on unemployed youth, some of whom are thought to be by the local communities to be drug users, paid to go out and cause trouble. That is where the violence seems to be coming from. We have people on the protesting side who are not necessarily targeting people who are their enemies, but just targeting for the heck of it.
So you are saying, and you've written, that the violence seems to be coming by these large numbers of unemployed young people and anger in that population. But what has been happening, in your view, to the ethnic violence, the fighting between the Luo and the Kikuyu? You write today that evidence is now that a lot of this violence in some parts of the country was orchestrated by the opposition party, which would be the Luo tribe. What's happening with that ethnic violence?
There have been reports coming into human rights organizations here where opposition leaders have been giving speeches, at least in the lead-up to the elections, using code language that the stains need to be removed from the local society. These are thought to be innuendos that the local community needs to kick out, the Kikuyus. The opposition party, of course, denies any sort of ties with that. But what's happening in the countryside is continued ethnic violence, whether orchestrated or not. Communities are against each other. Kikuyus are leaving in large numbers. We went to a town called Nakuru in the Rift Valley, where much of the violence has taken place. In a single stadium, 10,000 people. are finding shelter. The Kenyan Red Cross is struggling to be able to feed them all. Many are sleeping out in the open, and unfortunately, conditions are quite bad. They're still streaming in part because of these mass rallies. So whether organized or not, the overall sense of insecurity leads people to flee.
Scott Baldoff, Christian Science Monitor correspondent in Nairobi. Scott, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And joining us now, Caroline Elkins, Associate Professor of African Studies at Harvard University. Her book, Imperial Reckoning, The Untold Story of Britain's Gulag in Kenya, won the Pulitzer for Best Nonfiction in 2006. And for many, Caroline, that was the first time we became familiar with the Kikuyu tribe. And I don't want to get ahead and, you know, talk about that history. First, I just want to get your impressions of what you just heard from Scott Baldoff.
Yeah, I'm not at all surprised by what he's saying, and I think it's one thing, and in some ways to link it to history, it sounds resoundingly familiar to what we saw during the 1950s, and that is, yes, we have something that starts off as a kind of directed ethnic violence, but what happens is this takes on a life of its own, and you have people locally who have vendettas to settle, who have real or perceived fears of their neighbors, and yes, you can have it directed at first, but once that happens and once it's unleashed, it can't be controlled, and that's precisely what we're seeing going on in places, as Scott pointed out, like Nakuru, where you have 10,000 people trying to find shelter in what is, we think of it as a stadium. I mean, this is just an open-air place with some seats around it. This is not a stadium as one would think of in the United States sense.
You've spent quite a bit of time in the country. Well, this violence between the Kikuyu and the Luo surprised many people. And further, the Kikuyu immediately were seen as the brutal suppressors. The Kikuyu president is charged with rigging the election. But it would seem to be much more complicated than that. So briefly, what is the history of these two peoples?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we do need to go back in this instance and take a look at even, let's move ourselves back prior to the colonial period, because I think one of the misnomers is that, not just in this case, Kikuyu and Luo, but throughout Africa, we've got a situation where tribes have always lived in tribes, and they hate each other. Well, for the most part, that's not true. And culturally, yes, they did assimilate prior to the European coming into Africa, but what we see happening are them being formed into distinct political units during the colonial period, distinct political units that are divided and ruled separately. And they're also divided and ruled separately, given different spoils of the state. So in other words, this kind of antagonistic relationship is set up between them. And there's consistently a fear, both by the British colonizers and other African minority groups in Kenya, of Kikuyu ascendancy. And this kind of fear has permeated the history of Kenya from the early 20th century until now.
We want to hear more from Caroline Elkins. She's Associate Professor of African Studies at Harvard, and her Pulitzer Prize-winning book is Imperial Reckoning. It's a history of Kenya. So we will do that to find out how that history is impacting what we're hearing about today and what you think should happen now. And by the way, we also today are going to take a look at mudslinging here in the U.S. in South Carolina, the smear campaigns going on in the presidential race ahead of Saturday's Republican primary, Shades of 2000. We'll have that later in the program as well. Back with more from Caroline in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with more from Caroline Elkins. Her book, Imperial Reckoning, The Untold Story of Britain's Gulag in Kenya, won the Pulitzer for Best Nonfiction in 2006. So who better to help us understand what's going on in Kenya today? And Caroline, you were just saying that, you know, what is seen as ethnic unrest, ethnic violence in Kenya today had its roots in history and colonialism, when tribes were sort of pitted against each other and politicized. And yet, were the Kikuyu, who are seen as dominant today and oppressing the Luau today, were they once also oppressed?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've seen sort of a rise and fall in this, and certainly during the Moi period, which is one of the longest dictatorships in Africa.
President Arap Moi.
Exactly. We see the Kikuyu being on the receiving end of things. And I think the most fundamental point in my mind to understand in all of this, Robin, is that ethnicity is about, or the use of ethnicity in politics, is about elite politics, right? And how to use the poor masses, if you will, as proxies for elite wars. And one of the most potent things one can play is the ethnic card. So over and over and again, this becomes about elite power politics, whether the colonial period or the post-colonial period. And over and again, the same subtext throughout this is the poor peasant getting screwed over and over and over again.
But is this Rwanda, what we're seeing now? Is this, you know, Hutus given machetes and told to kill Tutsis? I mean, is this...
Yeah, I mean, we've seen that come up in a lot of the press. And, you know, I, I think what's disturbing for me as somebody who studies Africa is, you know, you see Paris burning. Does anybody say, gosh, is this Bosnia? Mm-hmm. Right? In this particular case, no, it's not Rwanda. We don't have the kind of state-directed genocide. Yes, we, as Scott was pointing out, we hear grumblings about sort of getting rid of scourges and this sort of thing. This is not taking to the radio waves. This is not the state arming people with machetes. This is something different. But yet ethnicity, as it plays out in politics, can take on the violent dimension. And when it does and it's unleashed, the fact of the matter is we can't control it.
Now, the New York Times quoted a member of the Kalenjin tribe, a tribe we have not yet mentioned, as saying, we hate these people, speaking of the Kikuyus. Mm-hmm. That kind of broad sort of, you know, that feeds into the, you know, those looking from the outside, it feeds into this idea that, well, these are just groups of people who hate each other.
Yeah, and I think, Robin, neighbors don't wake up one day and decide to kill each other, right? And mm-hmm. and hate is a kind of fear. And again, if you think about elite politics and deploying fear, no different than how issues like race are deployed in our own country. How better to galvanize supporters than to play on their fears?
Well, you actually make a comparison, which we've also made with Iraq. You know, people saying, geez, the Shia and the Sunni, they're still fighting after 2003. And, you know, people have compared that to, you know, the tensions in the South after the Civil War, which went on for 100 years. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You've made comparisons between the U.S. and Africa in that way.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if we look at this, many people will say to me, gosh, you know, the colonial period's so long ago. Well, let's look at it, right? Colonial period ended late 50s, early 60s, followed quickly on the heels by the Cold War, where politics were being played out East versus West. If we look at sort of free-playing democracy, if you will, it's only been since the fall of the Soviet Union. And then if we can take the comparison to the United States and we look at the contemporary election campaign going on right now and what's being said about gender and race, how long has it been in this country since women and African Americans got the vote? It's been a heck of a lot longer than 10 or 50 years.
By the way, what is the role of the West in any of this? We found ourselves wondering, many of us who've traveled there and traveled quickly through Nairobi to go to Tanzania to mm-hmm. climb Mount Kilimanjaro and perhaps not talk to as many Kenyans on the way as we now think we maybe should have as we went to safari, you know, somewhere else. How much does the role, or does the role of the American tourist have any part in this at all? We know here in the U.S., places that are tourist destinations are also often resentful of the
right.
people who come through and then leave. Is there any of that, you know, percolating in Kenya as well?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a great question, because I think one thing that, at least my own experience has been, is the ability for the Kenyans that I know across a wide socioeconomic span to distinguish between the American tourist and the American government. And by and large, I see no resentment against the American tourist, per se.
Even though, as we know, people are changing their travel plans like crazy right
Absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely. And but yet, I think that there's very much the sentiment, a very strong sentiment, against the American government. And I think, this is universal, Robin. This is not contained to Kenya. And insofar as the Kenyans will look at the United States in the election of 2000 and what's going on with the war in Iraq and the, you know, where are the weapons of mass destruction, and saying, how can these people possibly have the moral authority to come in and tell us how to run our country?
Well, but on the other hand, we are hearing from analysts who say that the U.S. has got, it's the U.S. Pressure from the U.S. and the U.N. and other Western countries on these two leaders, the opposition mm-hmm. leader and the sitting president, to have a dialogue. It's that pressure
right.
that maybe may
right.
bring this to a solution.
But this gets back to my point about the poor peasant being screwed. Because what they're going to do, and we've seen it in the press today, they're going to withhold funding, right? And who is it going to hit? Mm-hmm. It's not going to hit Raila Odinga, who's a flamboyant millionaire, as he's called in the press. It's not going to hit Kibaki, who's got bank accounts in Switzerland and all over the world.
The president.
It's going to hit the 60% of the people who make less than $2 a day already. That's who it's going to hit. And so, therefore, this kind of policy is nonsense.
What do you think should happen?
Well, I think at this juncture, what we need to see happening is we need to see some kind of coalition going on with the Kibaki government. And frankly, what we need to see Kibaki be more reasonable. But at the same time, I think it's a gross misnomer for us to be thinking that Odinga is this kind of man of the people.
I mean, he's the opposition leader.
He's the opposition leader. And, you know, listen, the election was rigged. And my suspicion is, and many people on the spot, is that it was rigged on both sides. Nobody's a Boy Scout in all of this.
Well, finish your thought. So Odinga, if not Odinga,
so,
who?
So I think what we need to see in the short term is some kind of coalition government with them getting along. It was a bit of a circus when they took seats in parliament earlier on this week, and with the idea that we have some kind of run-up to yet another election, but not in the near term, Robin. People are frightened. You're not going to see people turn out to the polls. This is something where we're going to need to see another election, but a year from now is probably more reasonable.
Well, and analysts are also saying another election, but yet neither party can really afford it right now.
No, yeah. Absolutely not. Yeah. Absolutely not.
And in the meantime, do you expect the violence to tamp down out of even maybe sheer exhaustion, but this new element in just the few seconds we have of the young kids who are unemployed entering the picture?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Do you expect it to get worse?
Yeah, no, I actually think I would expect to see it dampening down, because I think that we're going to see the government cracking down. And at this point, Kibaki's no fool. He's going to wait it out, and it's working.
Caroline Elkins, Associate Professor of African Studies at Harvard University, again author of the book Imperial Reckoning, The Untold Story of Britain's Gulag in Kenya. She won the Pulitzer for that in 2006. Caroline, a pleasure as always to speak with you.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Okay. Tomorrow, we're going to touch down in Nevada. They have their party caucuses on Saturday, so we'll do that for you. But still ahead today, Iranian author Marjan Satrapi on her new film, Persepolis. News is next, here and now. John McCain goes into this Saturday's Republican presidential primary in South Carolina with a lead in three polls out today and with better armor than he had when he ran in 2000. Yesterday, in looking ahead to Saturday's Republican primary, we asked a reporter in an offhand way if some of those ugly false rumors spread about John McCain when he ran in 2000 were alive and well. To our surprise, the reporter said yes and added, the smear campaigns have only gotten worse. Well, as Elizabeth Buemiller writes in today's New York Times, this time around, John McCain is prepared. He's set up a truth squad to out people involved in whisper campaigns against him. He's even set up a tipster hotline.
Hi, you've reached the McCain 2008 negative campaign alert hotline. Please leave us your name, your phone number, and a brief description of the negative campaign material you received. Thank you.
McCain's isn't the only campaign getting splattered with mud. Even by South Carolina's notoriously dirty standards, this presidential race has been a doozy. Everything from flyers accusing McCain, a POW, of selling out other POWs to save himself, to a Christmas card that falsely claimed to be from Mitt Romney, extolling the virtues of polygamy. And New York Times Washington correspondent Elizabeth Buemiller joins us on the line with more. She's been reporting from South Carolina. Elizabeth, let's remind listeners what happened to John McCain in South Carolina in 2000. The lie was that his wife, Cindy, was a drug addict and he had a love child.
That's right. There were a lot of ugly rumors that went around all over the place, but that John McCain and Cindy McCain's daughter, Bridget, who they had adopted from Mother Teresa's orphanage in Bangladesh, she was portrayed as a black love child of John McCain.
Of course, that was a lie. Well, you had a chance to listen to one of the automated phone calls that attacks McCain this time around.
Yes.
What did it allege, and who'd you find out was responsible?
There is there's a guy out in Colorado Springs named Patrick Davis, who is a former political director of the Republican Senatorial Committee, Campaign Committee, in 2004. So he has ties to Washington. He's a Huckabee supporter, although he says that his group is independent of Huckabee and the Huckabee campaign has disavowed any connection to him, and they say they've asked him to stop the calls. But, you know, if you get the call, it's automated, and they ask first who you're supporting, and if you say John McCain, then the call says, well, are you aware that John McCain supports medical research on unborn babies? And then the call asks again, well, now who are you supporting? And if you still say John McCain, the call then goes on to say, well, are you aware that he presided over the greatest attack on free speech in America, which is the campaign finance reform bill that he sponsored with Russ Feingold.
Are these calls? This is automated, right? It's a so-called robocall.
Right. I mean, it's a real voice, of course, but it kicks in when you based on your answer.
Right. Are these calls legal?
They're looking into it in South Carolina right now. There is a law in South Carolina. It's not in every state, but in South Carolina, it is illegal to make an automated phone call to a person. If the answering machine picks it up, it's okay. But if a person answers, it's not. So I don't see how they're going to. It's going to be hard to check. But they're checking in South Carolina. The Attorney General, State Attorney General, is, as it happens, a McCain supporter.
Well, what are some of the other attacks against John McCain this time around? Is it possible? There seems to be a whiff of Swift boating, the attack against John Kerry, and that there's a group calling itself Vietnam Vets that's questioning John McCain's time as a POW?
That's right. Now, this group, I have to tell you, I reached the person who is leading this group, and yesterday in Rockland County in New York, very close to West Point, and he said he was basically the only person in the group. But he said he sent out this a flyer that shows a cartoon of John McCain in a prison cell in North Vietnam, and it, behind him there's some writing saying, you know, that he had sold out his fellow POWs to save himself. And this man is Mr. Kiley. He's a former, he's a Vietnam veteran. He's 61 years old. He'd said he was had worked for 40 years for a major New York corporation, which he declined to name. And he said that his flyer had been distributed by a veterans online newspaper. I couldn't reach the publisher of this newspaper. It's only online. And it's unclear how widely it was distributed, but his complaint and criticism of McCain is that he felt McCain gave up too much information to the North Vietnamese and is wrongly being praised as a war hero.
Well, as you write, John McCain this time around has come into the state a front runner, a lot of money behind him. He's set up different ways to attack these ads, something he couldn't do in 2000. But he's not the only candidate. We're reading that Barack Obama also has sort of a truth squad on his website, because there's an email campaign circulating that claims that he was a Muslim, was raised at a radical Islamic school as a child, that he's not patriotic. You know, he's a Christian and attended a non-religious public school in Indonesia. So those are, you know, some of those are smears against him as well. How dirty is this campaign this time around compared to others?
Well, I don't mean to disparage South Carolina. It's a beautiful state, but I think that this is basically what happens in South Carolina. It happened last time, and I think it's very specific to this state right now. We'll see what happens in the general election, but we didn't quite see this level of mudslinging in the other states. Although the person we were talking about earlier, Patrick Davis, did have those automated calls in Nevada and Iowa, New Hampshire. So far the McCain attacks are not as incendiary as they were in 2000.
Although we were told by a reporter yesterday that people still believe the 2000 attacks, and I'm just wondering, how complicit are the campaigns in all of this? Mitt Romney, who has been smeared, as we said, just hired Warren Tompkins, who was someone who worked for the Bush campaign in 2000, and some say was responsible for the attacks against McCain in 2000, and he's just been hired by Mitt Romney. So
right, well, he's been hired a while ago by Mitt Romney.
Right.
Yes, well, certainly the McCain supporters in South Carolina believe that he was behind some of the
he denies that
he absolutely denies it, but yeah, they believe that the McCain supporters believe that he was behind the attacks on McCain in 2000.
Are they all, you know, in some ways also playing ball by hiring people who might have participated in this?
Right. Well, that, of course, you hire someone like that to also as a defensive line against attacks on you. I mean, this guy knows how it's done, if he, in fact, was involved in 2000.
Elizabeth B. Mueller, Washington correspondent for The New York Times. Well, one last political note. One Republican not on the campaign trail in South Carolina is Mitt Romney. ABC News reports that Romney has ceded that state to his rivals. In fact, he says he believes Senator McCain has already wrapped up a win in South Carolina. Instead, Romney is moving on to Nevada today. He'll be the only major Republican candidate to really campaign hard there. Caucuses for both parties will be held there this weekend, and the state has become a major battleground for Democrats. But Romney points out that Nevada has 34 Republican delegates up for grabs, compared to South Carolina, which only has 24. And in this wide-open Republican race, every delegate is going to count. We'll continue, of course, to follow that race. You're listening to Here and Now. We first talked to artist and author Marjane Satrapi back in 2003 when her graphic novel Persepolis came out. Last year, she visited with her latest novel, Chicken with Plums, and at that time, she told us the exciting news that she was going to make Persepolis, her story of growing up in Iran before and after the 1979 revolution, into an animated movie. Well, boy, did she ever.
Je l'avais dit. Je vous l'avais dit. Je l'avais dit. Nous sommes en train de vivre un moment historique.
In this scene, crowds in Tehran call for the fall of the Western-backed Shah as Marjane's father brings her to the window to watch the historic moment. Satrapi's pen and ink drawings of her family's political struggles against the Shah, the disastrous Islamist regime that followed, and her own struggles to find identity as an Iranian woman are now transferred beautifully to the big screen. Satrapi co-directed Persepolis, drew all the characters, and she joins us now on the line. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Robin. Thank you for having me again.
I should say, that worked out well.
Yes. I was not sure, actually, that it would go well, you know. It's not because you're a good cartoonist that you will become a good director, you know. But, well, I try to do my best.
Well, what's your reaction to seeing it up on the big screen? Because, some things that I noticed, some of the characters really pop out for me in ways that they might not have necessarily in the book. Because, for instance, your grandmother, I really, in the film, caught her pain at seeing what you went through. It just really, you know, it stood out.
No, absolutely. You're completely right because, you know, there were also so many characters that we couldn't put in the movie, like the maid that was very important to me or my childhood friend, etc. But then, you know, we could have more time on other characters. And actually, my grandmother played a big role, actually, in my education. So it was very obvious that she would be more in the movie. But when you see it on the big screen, you know, you feel a little bit like God. You know, like, you know, God created the man and said, now you stand up and walk. And, you know, you make this drawing and suddenly your drawing, they start walking and talking and doing all sorts of things. So right. it's very shocking the first time.
Right. And it's not just characters and drawings. It's you.
Yes, absolutely. But in order to be able to make this movie, because I had to work with a team of 100 person, I had to stop to talk about myself. I always had to say her and she and her parents because, you know, people, they cannot work with you because then they feel that they have to be careful all the time. So I had to detach myself from the main character.
Let's start with as a child, as a little girl. How would you describe the little girl that was watching from, like, knee level as the parents dealt with, for instance, the fall of the Shah?
Well, actually, you know, I grew up with the idea that the Shah was, you know, the king and, you know, because we didn't have really the freedom of speech. So even my parents said they were not very much for the Shah. They never talked anything against him because, you know, for me not to repeat it in the school. So suddenly, you know, you're at the age of 9 and they tell you the guy that was supposed to be the king and the best man in the universe, actually, he's not a good man. So that was a big shock. I had to concentrate to understand what was really happening, which was not always obvious, of course.
While at the same time, you were in love with Bruce Lee.
Oh, yes.
And, you know,
it's about the same thing, you know. Bruce Lee was making justice. The revolution was about making justice, too. So, yeah. You know.
Well, and you had relatives who were very activist. Your uncle Nanush was imprisoned under the Shah.
Yes.
He's released. He comes to visit. And in this scene, again, it's in French with English subtitles, but we can hear the power of the emotion. You're asking him questions you want to know. You were a very inquisitive child. Let's listen.
Oncle Anouche, t'as passé combien de temps en prison?
9 ans, mon enfant.
Ah ouais? Plus que le père de Lali? T'as quel âge? Tu as une femme? Tu es communiste?
At this point, Marjane, although there's frightening moments, certainly it's exciting to you.
Yes, it was exciting because, you know, that was a moment that, you know, the whole country was believing in the change. The whole country was like, oh, we are going to get rid of a dictator and it's going to be democracy in the country. That was the way it was. And that was all these people coming out of the jail and saying all these incredible stories. So, yeah, that was really a very special moment. So, you know, just after that we had the war and after that the situation changed and the situation didn't get any better.
In fact, the situation got much worse as a repressive Islamic regime led by the Ayatollahs eventually replaced the Shah. We're speaking with artist, author, first-time filmmaker Marjane Satrapi. Her film Persepolis in French with subtitles won the jury prize at the Cannes Film Festival, is getting critical acclaim. Back with more with Marjane in 1 minute here and now. Our guest, Marjan Satrapi, the Iranian artist who turned her graphic novels about growing up into the new animated film Persepolis. As a little girl, she watched as relatives who opposed the Western-backed Shah were imprisoned or killed. She then watched the fall of the Shah, the subsequent Islamist revolution in 1979. Her moderate family donned headscarves and tried to dodge the new culture police of the repressive fundamentalist regime that replaced the Shah. In this scene, as a young teen, she goes to downtown Tehran to buy bootleg tapes and runs a gauntlet of men in trench coats selling lipstick, playing cards, as well as CDs by Julio Iglesias, Jackson, Michael, and Stevie Wonder.
Stevie Wonder.
Julio Iglesias.
Pink Floyd.
Chalkel Maxon. Rogerer. Verneon. Tartajoué.
Iron Maiden.
Iron Maiden. That's the one that gets you. Can you describe that disconnect between being someone who loved Western culture but lived with this police, social, you know, culture
yes,
police?
But what I wanted to show also, you know, is that adolescents, wherever they are in the world, you know, they want the same thing. You always want to poster of this pop singer in your room, and you always want to listen to this kind of music because, you know, that is the thing that happened everywhere. Plus, for us, it was something even more than that. Because since, you know, the border of the country were closed in AT and, you know, we didn't have any connection with outside, listening to the pop music, you know, wanting to, you know, have the posters in our room was also meaning that we had a connection with outside.
You were, you know, pretty outspoken and as a kid, and your parents finally decided it was too dangerous for you.
Yes.
And for the first of couple of times, sent you away. That scene in the airport where they send you to Vienna, I think it was?
Yes.
You turn, and you're a young teenager, you turn to walk away, and you turn back and see what?
My mother fainting.
Oh.
Yes. You know, but that's the kind of thing that happens, you know.
Did that really happen? I mean, your father had to carry your mother away, and you saw
that? Yes. But, you know, it's not, as I have always said, you know, of course it is based on my own experiences, but it's certainly not a documentary about mm-hmm. my life, you know. This scene, actually, that really happened. But I'm not very much, you know, talking about the reality. It's really the feeling of what happened, you know. Like this scene in the movie when a rocket comes and falls down and kills our neighbors. This thing actually happened, but it didn't happen when I was 13. That happened when I came back from Austria and mm-hmm. I was 18. But no matter, you know, if it happens when I was 13 or 18, when your neighborhood is bombed and when you have a friend who is dead that you're 13 or 18, the feeling remains the same, you know. It's exactly the same thing.
The movie also really underscores how when you did go away from home and you're confronted with full Western culture for the first time, how out of place you felt and how you spiraled out after a rotten relationship. And boy, payback is big in this movie, whoever that guy was that you broke up with. He doesn't fare well in the film. But then, you know, you go off. You really... Were you living on the streets?
Oh, yeah. I did that.
Because you had nowhere to live and you'd had this
heart... Oh, no, because my heart was broken and I was completely crazy in my brain, you know, because that was not just, you know, a question of heart, you know. I had the feeling that my whole life was finished.
Well, how much, though, was your reaction to that breakup and you're on the streets and, you know, starving and... in this foreign country, how much of that also was that your complete disconnect from a country? You were in a way homeless.
Yes, to start with, I think that you are completely right in what you say, but, you know, I never make anything, you know, a little bit, you know, like if I'm sad, I'm so sad that I become homeless, or if I'm happy, I'm so happy that I will explode in myself, you know. I cannot do anything like in a light way. Even now I'm overreacting, so, you know, it doesn't change, you know.
Well, speaking of which, when you finally do come, you return home kind of, you know, a little humble from what had happened to you during the trip, to the embrace of your family.
Yes.
And you find something in yourself through a dream, through a conversation with God, through the, you know, support of your grandmother, and through, again, pop music, to set yourself on track again to be an artist despite what's happening in the repressive regime there. Let's listen to when Survivor's Eye of the Tiger becomes your moment of liberation.
Eat my time, took my chances. When the teeth and I'm back on my feet, just a man and his will to survive.
Rising up to the challenge of a rival. Was there a moment like that, or is that a metaphor for something that happened to you?
No, of course it's a metaphor. It's a metaphor, especially, you know, this survivor music, like, you know, rising up, you know, back on the street and all of that. You know, it's such a vision, like, yeah, if you want, you can succeed. You know, most of the time you want and you don't succeed.
Meanwhile, after that very funny scene, you know, heartbreaking scenes of students killed trying to run away from a secret party and, you know, right up next to each other.
That is how life is about, you know, and this idea that, you know, there are some places that people only suffer. Total happiness doesn't exist, but total sadness doesn't exist. So it has been many, very many moments that we had to laugh and we had to party, and that was really a matter of surviving.
Well, because of all of that, because of the different contrasts that you see in Iran, you've said you wanted this film to show Western audiences that Iranians are human beings. They're not just abstract notions like a fundamentalist or a terrorist.
Yes.
Do you think you've achieved that?
I don't know if I have achieved that, but I hope that I will achieve it. You know, I mean, my pretension, I don't think that with a movie you can change the world or, you know. But the problem is that today, in today's world, we talk about everything but about the human being. We're always, you know, going towards abstract notion. We forget that people are just like us. You know, like today, you know, what is happening in Iraq, every day, you know, you have 100, 200, 50, 10 people dying, and nobody cares really, because people, they have forgotten that these people, they're human beings, you know, that they have brothers and sisters and parents and hope and love. If by this movie, you know, people, they can say to themselves, that, you know, the people that they're so scared of, they're just people like them. And these people are exactly the first victim of fanaticism. They're the people themselves.
On the other hand, do you worry that because of the negativity that is in the film, you know, again, these secret police and the way women had to live and the way people became enshrouded and frightened, do you worry that you might be complicit in people who only want to paint Iran as negative, as, you know, helping them to do that?
I don't think so. First of all, you know, I don't think that, you know, with a movie you can create or stop a war. But I think the reason that we can make a war is that we forget that people are people. You know, what I'm showing also is the complexity of the situation. Plus, is another thing also, is that my movie stops at 1994. The situation is not the same, first of all.
But tell me a little about that. Many Americans see Ahmadinejad calling for Israel to be wiped off the map. What would you want people to know about Iran today?
If there is any change that has to come in any country, it has to come from within the country. You cannot, for any reason in the world, go and attack a country. Like, for example, we are going to bring democracy. You know, democracy is not a gift that you give to people by bombing them. It doesn't happen this way.
Well, I was going to ask you about this because you haven't been in the country for 8 years.
Yes.
Your mother in the film says to you, Iran is no place for you because of the problems. Some would say she must be a candidate for the U.S. going in and overthrowing the current regime.
No, I think people, they would say, we think this way, they should be perverts because... you know, Iran belongs to the Iranian as America belongs to the American. If there is any changes that should come from Iranian, you know, I mean, this kind of attack doesn't have any issue. I mean, I cannot understand people that see what is the result of a war in Iraq. How can they support another idea of war? Mm-hmm. It's not because you criticize a place that you want in this place to be war, you know. And war does not kill the leaders. War kills the innocent people. That is what I'm showing in the movie. When a war happens, that is innocent people that dies.
Marjan Satrapi, co-director of the film Persepolis, which is based on her graphic novels, Persepolis 1 through 4, now out in a complete version. Marjan, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Robin.